outside. We couldn't see it from our vantage point.
Wrestling fans, and welcome to our Vantage Point SummerSlam Spectacular.
Wow, the music.
The music, of course. I am Joe Murata, alongside, as always, Mr. Michael Quinn, and we are glad to be with you for this special Thursday edition of our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast, as we creep towards, Quinn, the biggest party of the summer, allegedly,
yeah.
SummerSlam.
Allegedly.
That's allegedly what we're creeping towards. Now, folks, we hope you enjoyed episode number 44 this past Monday. We're back again midweek, helping you end your week right and start your weekend soon. We're going to go through SummerSlam from a retro vantage point, if you will, Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
You like that?
Yeah.
That's pretty good,
very
right?
Clever.
Thank you very much. And we'll be joined by a very special guest. I'm sure you know who that is. But before we get to any of that, just want to remind you, of course, you can find us on Twitter at OVP Podcast. You can tweet at us. We like the GIFs, Quinn, and the retweets and the things.
The Jiffies and all that.
Yeah, the Jiffies. And you can also email us if you use that. That is OVPPodcast@gmail.com. And Quinn, we have a Facebook group that's really been heating up, so to speak.
Heating up like SummerSlam.
Yeah, no pun intended there.
Yeah, you can go to Facebook.com, search for Our Vantage Point, and you'll see the discussion group. Hit join, and you're good to go. You can talk about the Superfest or Slam Summers or whatever.
It's a good time. And Quinn, obviously we're hosted on SoundCloud, but that's not the only place to listen to us. Where else is there?
You can get us over at Apple Podcast. Mm-hmm. Click the subscribe button. Leave a review. We love those. Also, you can go to Google Play Music, Stitcher, Blueberry.
Who cares?
Yeah, exactly. And other various places.
And other various places, one of which, of course, is placetobenation.com. It's a great little network there, Quinn. They've got some great wrestling-related content. Our show happens to be on there, so you can listen to us twice.
Yes, as usual.
It's a very good thing to do.
Yeah.
And you know what came out today? Greetings from Allentown. That's another great show.
GF Allentown.
GF Allentown with Petey Winson, our little brother.
Yeah.
Little Petey. So go over to the placetobenation.com. You can find some great content there. And like I mentioned, we're here to talk to you about the SummerSlam, as Bret Hart would say.
As he always said.
The SummerSlam.
Yeah. In the SummerSlam.
And SummerSlam is a pretty big deal in terms of pay-per-views. Obviously, if you remember Monday's show, folks, we talked about the Mount Rushmore and Death Valley of SummerSlam main events.
Oh, we did.
This time around, we have, of course, a very special guest. He is a published author, a wrestling pundit, an all-around great guy, and a Canadian. It is Saskatoon's Sultan of Smark, Mr. Scott Keith. How you doing, man?
Well, you know, SummerSlam is my jam, so that's, this is good tonight. I got a fire going in the backyard here, so I'm feeling the heat, you know?
Oh,
so
all
very good tie-ins here with the event that we got going on.
Wait, a fire? What temperature is it up there?
17 degrees Celsius right now.
Okay. Is that about 50-something?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. We'll leave it to the folks to figure out. Scott, as always, thank you for joining us. Where can people find you these days?
All over the place. Of course, there's my website at blogofdoom.com when it's not being hacked.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, so, and of course, I write for the Sporting News as well. I do a weekly column. Using my Doc Brown chalkboard here to figure out the timing of when people will be hearing this. The one that should be up now would be the worst attempts to recreate classic tag teams with other wrestlers.
Ooh,
so that should be the most recent one that just comes out as this podcast is released. But we'll see how the timeline flows. I'm not sure.
We'll see how it goes. I mean, really, we're live, but let's not tell anyone that. You know?
Okay, yeah.
I'm just kidding. No. So, Scott, you have tons of experience watching wrestling, and that's obviously why we bring you on here. You're an expert when it comes to the retro wrestling, which is the field that we deal with.
That's my thing. Yes.
That's your thing, and that's why we appreciate having you here. Scott, I want to start here at the very beginning. When it comes to SummerSlam, I think we're all kind of in agreement, and I think the WWE would agree too. Is that their number two pay-per-view of the year?
Depends how you look at it, I guess, actually. As far as buy rate goes, usually Royal Rumble is number two, but as far as importance goes, I mean, like, you know, the way, especially since they moved it to Brooklyn, it's become such a big thing, just like WrestleMania, right, where they have a series of four different shows at Barclays Center, and it's, you know, they do this whole weekend now. So I'd say in their minds, it's the number two show now.
Yeah, That's true. They've gentrified SummerSlam.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Just like the LA. They recently did that with the LA, too.
Yes, they did.
A couple years before.
Mm-hmm, so. They were doing the Staples Center for several years.
I guess it's the same now.
I guess that's what they do now, is they just keep it at one place for a few years. Is that their new deal?
Yeah, it seems to be. They sign a deal for a few years to keep it there, I think, and then, yeah. Guaranteed sellouts, basically, right?
Exactly. It's consistent. You can count on it every single year. But obviously, SummerSlam folks started way back in 1988. And even though it may be the second in importance in terms of pay-per-view, it was actually the third one that the WWF did as a pay-per-view. Obviously, WrestleMania had started in 1985. Survivor Series was introduced in November of 1987. And they did dabble with the Royal Rumble on the USA Network, not on pay-per-view, in January of 88. But SummerSlam in August of 88 was their third, pay-per-view of the big four, of what came to be the big four.
Like ever, right?
Yeah. So, Scott, what kind of background do you have? What do you know about how SummerSlam came into being?
First of all, I want to throw out a shout out to my boy, Justin Henry, over at What Culture.
Okay.
I've been slavishly watching the fascinating facts about SummerSlam videos with that he writes, and then Adam narrates there, and they've been fantastic, so you get a lot of juicy information from those that I can feel free to steal. But as for the background of SummerSlam, I think it's well known that Vince McMahon is only out to help himself and not hurt the other guy.
So
that's what he tells us. So, I mean, it's, you know, it was shown again in SummerSlam, because at the time, back in 1988, as a way to help himself and not hurt the other guy, Vince had an exclusivity deal with all the pay-per-view providers. And the deal said that if the WWF put on a pay-per-view event, then nobody else was, they were not allowed to carry a pay-per-view event from any other provider, from any, like any other wrestling company, for 30 days before or 30 days after.
Okay.
So, around July of 1988, Ted Turner and TBS were co-producing pay-per-views for the NWA, and which became World Championship Wrestling. And so they came up with a great idea. Ted Turner was like, hey, we got the Great American Bash Tour that we're doing. We should cap this off with a pay-per-view in July of 1988. We'll call it the Great American Bash. And that was great. And then Vince McMahon said, oh no, sorry, I forgot to mention, we're doing this pay-per-view in August called SummerSlam, but we hadn't mentioned before, but yeah, it's going to be there now, so you can't be on pay-per-view with the Great American Bash.
So a lot like the Survivor Series situation.
So a lot like the Survivor Series situation, yes. So amazingly, they came up with this pay-per-view that they had been intending to do all along, but just hadn't mentioned to anybody until a couple of months before.
Oh, you know, they just wanted to keep it a secret, obviously, right?
They just wanted to keep it a secret.
Secret slam.
Yes. Secret slam.
So astonishingly, Great American Bash had to be moved up a month before to get it out of the way of SummerSlam. And everybody was happy, and it worked out great for everybody.
Yeah, it worked out great for Vince, of course.
Worked out great for Vince. How about that, huh?
Yeah. It's amazing, actually.
It always does.
It does. Now, when it comes to SummerSlam 88, that was held at the Garden, and it was a big feel to it from everything I've seen. Mm-hmm. I happen to have... I have odd feelings about that pay-per-view, to be honest with you.
Quinn, I don't know why. I think it's a feel-good pay-per-view. I don't have any problems with the 88 SummerSlam.
It might be Billy Graham.
He's attacking a man with a junkyard dog, brother. Like I said, he's got a head as hard as a coconut, my man.
Might be Billy Graham. Scott, what are your thoughts overall on 88?
Well, Billy Graham is, of course, one of the worst color commentators of all time.
Yes.
So, yeah, that was there. I mean, obviously it has some of the best, some incredible moments, like primarily the, you know, Ultimate Warrior beating Honky Tonk Man.
Right.
In 30 seconds, which was, you know, an amazing part of my childhood that I rented the tape and wore it out watching it back and forth over and over again. So that was pretty fantastic. The main event always felt kind of like, originally that's not, you know, the way the main event was supposed to go. This was part of the whole thing with Ted DiBiase supposed to get the world title and keep it until SummerSlam and probably either lose it to Hulk Hogan or Randy Savage or some combination thereof. And then that got screwed up. So like, we ended up with the tag team match with the Mega Powers, which ended up working out well in the long run.
Yeah, I think it did. And if you look at it, too, on paper, it is a pretty high-profile match for that period of time.
She is now our manager, and you and I are fighting for her honor, Macho Man.
No way, I don't think so.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I always think of this as like the height of like Randy Savage's first reign. If you really think about it,
as a face,
smack in the middle, and like it's, you know, he's teaming with Hogan, and I don't know, everything just feels good about it, and the secret weapon with Elizabeth, like,
yep, and Jesse Ventura's in the middle of everything,
yeah,
oh yeah. As far as circus atmosphere goes, yeah, for sure, there's a lot of things in that, right?
Exactly.
It's not the greatest match I've ever seen, but I mean, I don't know. I love the whole way it plays out. I've said it on this show a million times. It's one of my, that's kind of why it's one of my favorite pay-per-views.
I understand.
Yeah.
I think it still has a bit of an odd feel to it. One of the things I did want to bring up about SummerSlam 88 is it seemed like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Scott or Quinn, there were some matches where people were fighting people they weren't feuding with. I seem to remember something to do with like Rick Rude against, I think it was Junkyard Dog instead of Jake Roberts, something like that.
Yeah, so basically that was the kind of a primary function of the booking at the time, right? So the thought process going on at the time from guys like George Scott was that you don't want to give away the house show main events on TV, essentially, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was basically the thinking, was that, you know, why give away, they don't want to give away Jake Roberts against Rick Rude, for example, on a pay-per-view, because that's not the way the business functioned at that point. It was still very much geared towards driving people to go see the rematch in Madison Square Garden the next month, where you actually would see Jake Roberts against Rick Rude. So, I mean, it was understandable there, right? You have one or two marquee matches, and then the rest is just kind of like disposable throwaway garbage that's on there to fill out the pay-per-view time.
Right.
I also seem to recall the Big Boss Man fighting Coco Beware for some reason.
Yes.
And yep.
It's kind of a weird thing. He just kind of destroys him.
He does.
It's a little strange.
Yeah, it's a very, very oddly put together show overall.
Mm-hmm.
They were still fine either way with the pay-per-view thing. SummerSlam 88 didn't do what you would call great business for the WWF either. Like okay. It was, even by early pay-per-view standards, it was very mid-level. It's actually kind of surprising they continued on with it, other than the factor of spite. And, you know, powerful force, but, you know, and the fact that, you know, making a couple of $1 million off a pay-per-view is still better than making a couple $100,000 off a house show.
Well, I'll say this about it. After, you know, when you watch that first one, the timing of where it is in the year, it had an atmosphere to it the first summer. It really, like, I know it's a little, like, hit over the head with it, but it feels like it's hot in there and things are going on, doesn't it? Like, it's going to sound stupid.
Well, the garden was a pretty hot, sweaty place back then, you know? So that's 1988, folks. Moving on to 1989, which was in Jersey this time. They just moved across the Hudson River to the Meadowlands.
Yeah, right in our neck of the woods.
Right in our neck of the woods there. This was not on paper as good a main event. And it, of course, is Hulk Hogan and Brutus Beefcake teaming up against Macho Man and Zeus. And Scott, I have to ask you here, why with the Zeus?
Why with the Zeus? Zeus was drawing money.
What?
Yeah, no, I mean, as terrible as the movie was, like he didn't function very well as a heel in the movie, but I mean, as a wrestling heel, yeah, he was doing business. Like SummerSlam 89 was actually way up over 88.
What?
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's
strange.
True.
Wow.
It's strange, but true. But no, Zeus was actually a significant ratings mover when he did his appearances on Saturday Night's main event. So, I mean, it's really odd because, like, say, as far as a movie character goes, he was completely worthless. Didn't work at all, but you actually take that same character and put him in the context of wrestling, and it actually works.
Crazy.
For the short time, until, of course, he has a match, and then he's completely exposed, and then magic is gone after one match. But, you know.
You know what always took me by surprise about that match? It's this whole thing with Sherry, and why is she now like a witch? Like, and she knows like magic and stuff. Like, do you remember that? Like, they're showing them over like a cauldron or something. Like,
cauldron, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Where did that come from? Because I don't ever remember before or after Sherry being portrayed that way. It's such a weird thing, right?
It was weird.
And as the bubbles rise from the cauldron of magic, tiny particles will.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they needed, you know, magical intervention to get a match out of Zeus or something.
You know what? Yeah, that's a very fair point. I do remember the high spot of that match is Hogan body slams him, and Tony Schiavone sells him body slamming Zeus like it was Andre or something.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
He picked up Zeus! Like it was.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean, though. That's why it works so well.
He picked up Zeus!
You know, as like a jaded fan now, it's like, it's goofy and stuff, you know, watching it back. But I mean, at the time as a fan, I was terrified of Zeus, you know, I was like, oh my God, this guy's, you know, he's just like, I was more terrified that he was going to be in the title match at WrestleMania or something like that. But I mean, like, he was actually a pretty scary, effective character that Vince came up with for him.
Well, there you have it, folks. Scott Keith, wrestling pundit, published author, and an appreciator of Zeus.
There he is.
Okay, my appreciator more so than I was at the time, I will say. Let's not go crazy over the line here. Like that, all right? I don't want to be quoted out of context.
My apologies. Moving on, within 89, the opener is something I think always worth talking about. It's an excellent tag team match, Quinn, with the Hart Foundation against the Brain Busters. You recall that one, Michael?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was them feuding. Didn't they feud with each other for a little bit?
A little bit.
But it wasn't like a. That wasn't a title feud, right?
It wasn't.
I don't recall it being one.
It wasn't.
No, because the Brainbusters didn't have the titles at the time when the match was signed. So.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, actually, wasn't it really the Rockers that were in the midst of the Busters feud, or was that over by then, Scott?
Oh, yeah, no, it was very much Rockers and Brainbusters, yeah.
Right, so they kind of just threw the Hart Foundation out there for the sake of the pay-per-view, because I think Quinn and I were talking recently, didn't the Hart Foundation wrestle as singles for much of 89, except on pay-per-view?
Yeah, pretty much. They were doing stop and start pushes with Brett as a single for a while.
Right.
Especially against, you know, Bad News Brown and that kind of stuff. And yeah, it was a weird period for them. Like, you know, they basically, you know, from Brett's perspective, he kept getting promised these pushes, and then Vince would be like, no, yeah. Just take your idiot brother-in-law and go out there and have some more tag team matches. What we figure it.
You know, in a weird way, I feel like this, to me, it comes off as this is getting the most bang for their buck from the Brainbusters, them being there in the WWF, and they're feuding with the Rockers and the Hart Foundation, all these good workers. Did you think that was part of it a little bit, Scott?
Oh yeah, I think so. Like they were looking for real good opponents for them. I mean, like, you know, we can double back a little bit to SummerSlam 88 with the whole sure. Brainbuster situation as well, because I mean, like, the original plan for the stupid brother love segment with Axel Duggan, the idea was actually Ric Flair. Like they were actually trying to get Ric Flair to come in to do that. It came surprisingly close to happening, in fact. Which is another reason why they wanted to do the SummerSlam card on pay-per-view, because they figured that they would be signing the NWA World Champion, and, you know, this is something where they want to have it on there, and then, of course, that all fell through, and it was...
That would have been way...
Yeah, but it would have been way better, obviously. But, I mean, like, but that's the thing, though, is that they were kind of... That was kind of the rough intention, was to have, you know, Flair and then the Brainbusters come in, because then... And then bring J.J. Dillon in on the back end of it, and, like, kind of... That's kind of what they were shooting for there, but, obviously, when the Flair thing fell through, and then they just had the Brainbusters, then they had to kind of retool it. But I mean, I think they did pretty good with the Brainbusters for what they had.
I think so.
Tully and Arn were never guys that were going to succeed in the steroid promotion like the WWF. And I mean, they got themselves over really well until Tully, you know, flushed his career down the toilet.
Flushed his cocaine down the toilet too, probably.
Flushed his cocaine. He should have. I mean, if he'd done that, then he might have still be employed.
Yeah. And it shows, you know, the Busters came in, they were fresh, they were exciting, they were different.
Yeah.
And they had some excellent matches with the Rockers and the Hart Foundation. I love that that match is on there. And I love that that match happened, because it really is a great slice of kind of like an old school 80s tag formula. The heels kind of cheat to win.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an excellent little match.
Yeah, and I mean, the Brainbusters actually, like, they were consummate pros. Like, they knew how to have great matches with, like, all of these, they kind of, like, mid-level tag teams that they had on the babyface side there, right? Like, they come in, they could have, you know, a decent match with the Bushwhackers, even, if they had to, and, you know, the Rougeau brothers, you know. So, I mean, like, there was like, a variety of people that they could work with as well. Like, it was hard to get a really bad match out of the Brainbusters, typically.
Yeah.
No, they overall had a great tag roster at that point, and the Brainbusters were, like, a cherry on the top
at
that point, to me.
Well said, Quinn.
Yeah. Yep.
Another match at SummerSlam 89 that I think is kind of underrated, maybe it's not, but it may be underappreciated, and if I'm not mistaken, it's the Rockers and Tito Santana against Rick Martel and the Rougeaus. It's a great little six-man. It's very fun and very fast-paced for 89. You remember that one, Scott?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That one still annoys me, because in the sense that, you know, we've been waiting for the blow-off for Rick Martel against Tito Santana on pay-per-view forever, and we never got it. And, you know, it's just, it was frustrating. But, it was a great match. I mean, I loved it.
It's funny. I have good memories of that, because I remember Rick Martel cuts a really funny promo at the end. Something, you know, all that "you're a loser, Tito Santana."
Yeah,
but he's more like fired up than usual. And I just, it always made me laugh, that whole thing. Like, I don't know why.
Well, I'm sure I'll edit it in right about here. So
he doesn't have my look, my body, my ability, my speed, my agility. That's right, Santana. You don't have anything.
Yeah, that's a nice little match. Overall, the 89 card, gentlemen, what are your thoughts? Scott, I'll start with you.
I enjoy a lot of it for what it is. I really enjoyed the Rick Rude Ultimate Warrior match, which is basically Warrior's best match ever.
Yes.
And it also contains the all-time greatest Jesse Ventura rant ever committed to pay-per-view, where, you know, he's attacking him on the outside, and And Tony defends it by saying, oh, and it's, you know, it's on the outside. It doesn't count. Jesse's like, so what if he pulls out a gun and shoots him on the outside?
That's a disqualification. Where the hell is the referee?
That's outside of the ring, Jesse.
So what?
As much, it can just be a count out here.
What are you going to tell me, Shivani? You can shoot somebody outside the ring as long as it's outside the ring?
Well, no, that...
You know, you're even dumber than Monsoon.
That match was fantastic and set up a great feud with Rowdy Roddy Piper. And as noted, the six-man was great. The Brainbusters match was great. I don't really, honestly, when I'm watching the tape, I stop it before the main event. So I don't really have any specific memories of that.
I thought you liked Zeus.
Yeah, the big Zeus fan, right?
Yeah. You got to be careful, man. In the end, the Zeus people are going to hack the blog or something.
They're the culprits the whole time.
Yeah. They must people. Be. I'm trying to figure it out, the Zeus virus or something. But yeah. No, I mean, overall, yeah, I have good memories about the show, and I enjoy watching it, for sure. Aside from weird oddities like, you know, Dusty Rhodes and Honky Tonk Man getting, 15 minutes or whatever ridiculous thing it was.
Yeah,
that's weird. And that's another situation where a SummerSlam kind of scenario where someone's fighting someone they're not feuding with, because Dusty was feuding with Boss Man, was he not?
Yeah, that's right. And Terry Taylor and... Mr. Perfect, we're looking to have a really good match, but Taylor completely blew out his knee 30 seconds into the match, and they had to cut it short.
Yeah.
Like 2 minutes or whatever. So that could have been another, you know, great match that was tacked onto there. But, things happen.
Well, it should have been the match to determine if Rooster could win back the Mr. Perfect.
Oh, yeah, right. Well,
would you say the Rooster cocked it all up?
Oh! Okay.
Let's go to the 90s. So, SummerSlam 90 was in Philly this time, so we're staying within big markets at this point. I want to start by talking about the main event. It was a double main event, folks, and it was the first match of that double main event, which Hulk Hogan, returning from his big Get Well Hulkster thing that happened, Scott's favorite.
Yeah, my favorite.
Fighting Earthquake, John Tenta. And the second match of the double main event was the now world champion Ultimate Warrior fighting Rick Rude, defending his title in a steel cage match. And Scott, I want to ask you, do you think the Warrior being in a double main event now at his first pay-per-view defending the title, with Hogan right behind him in a match before and getting much of the hype, do you think that hurt the Warrior's reign, or did it not matter at that point?
Oh, no, it definitely hurt. He still had a chance to be salvaged there. And yeah, they would just... Anytime you say double main event in wrestling, that's code for, you know, Hulk Hogan, these matches don't have enough.
Yeah. Code for Hogan, yeah.
Code for Hogan, yeah.
That's true.
How many times has that happened?
WrestleMania
with
9, yeah. WrestleMania 8, yeah. SummerSlam 90. That's
every
true.
Match with Goldberg and WCW, you know.
Oh, shit, I forgot about that. Yeah, like in 98, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hogan always stole half of the main event.
He always had to have half the main event, yeah.
Now, the whole Earthquake Hogan thing, that was never really blown off. If I recall correctly, Hogan beats him by countout, I think. Did they ever... Why did they never blow this feud off?
Because he kept drawing money.
Oh, okay.
Typically what was happening, you know, in the house show run, is you'd have, you know, the bad guy would beat Hogan by countout or disqualification or whatever, and then they'd come back again, and Hogan would beat him on the second go-around, and, you know, houses would drop and drop and drop, right? And, you know.
Yeah.
But with the Earthquake thing, they kept drawing. So they, you know, did the first run and kept drawing, so they kept trying to keep it strong, and then they... You know, and then they did SummerSlam non-finish, and they did another round of house shows, and it was still going. And it was something like 4 or 5 go-arounds before they finally had Hogan beat him with a leg drop.
Interesting.
So I guess you would say Earthquake is the ultimate big fat heel.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah, he actually did very well against Hogan, which is what lends itself to the argument. And then Earthquake should have been the guy that Warrior was defending against.
Yeah, you know.
Having Hogan in there messing around, right?
Honestly, yeah, because that would have been much more of a threat, I think, for the Warrior. Not that Rude wasn't credible, but...
I have a whole thing with this.
Go ahead, Flynn.
I think that Rude was blundered more than anybody at this point in time, because we saw, you know, a couple years later that you could center a company around this guy, and I don't know, it just felt like they could have done more with Rude at this point in time.
Yeah, absolutely could have done more.
He just kind of loses here. He just kind of loses. And there's nothing else to it.
And he actually had just lost on Saturday Night's main event as well. It was a really weird sequence of things. I mean, he spent most of 89 getting beat by Warrior. Then, you know, he beat Jimmy Snuka at WrestleMania and cut his hair to heat him up again, right? And it's like, well, okay, he cut his hair. Okay, that's great. Give him the world title.
World title. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they did botch that. I'll tell you what, there was a great moment there. One of my personal favorite Hart Foundation matches. And of course, that's the Hart Foundation, winning the tag titles for the second time in a 2 out of 3 falls match against Demolition. Quinn.
Excellent.
Yeah, start with you, Quinn. What, you love that?
I love that. And to me, this is where we start to get into those good SummerSlam feelings that kind of went for about 3 years here with, I would say 90 to 92.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like these big, like, big babyface wins.
Honky Warrior was probably the template for that 88.
And then it just keeps rolling.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the big highlight in there.
Right.
In that SummerSlam. But yeah, just such great memories of that. And that was 2 out of 3 falls, right?
2 out of 3 falls.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yep.
So that was just excellent. And all the stuff with the demolition switching thing. And it was great because it had that feeling too of like the Hart Foundation, everything's going against them. They have no chance and they overcome them. It's just a great, just another feel good thing. And it goes along with the pattern. It's SummerSlam to me is always the feel good pay-per-view, at least at this point.
That's a good point. And it also has one of your favorite moments, Quinn, the Legion of Doom come out and look at Demolition.
Yes. That. Again, more evidence that Legion of Doom sucks.
Whoa.
But,
we talked about that already.
We have. Scott, I know, if I recall correctly, this match is a big favorite of yours, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of funny, actually, because going through and doing the old observers now on the website, it turns out back at the time, it was such a foregone conclusion that the Hart Foundation were getting the titles. Like, Bret Hart knew this, like, 3 months in advance or something like that. And, you know, Dave would just be talking about matter of fact, oh, yeah, Hart Foundation are getting the tag team titles at SummerSlam, blah, blah, blah.
Huh.
When they added Crush into there on TV, and it was like, wow, this is going to be bad news for the Hart Foundation, right? Because there's 3 of them.
Right.
You know, of course, you know, at the time, we didn't know, you know, what was going on in the bad blood with Axe and everything like that, and the reasoning behind adding Crush to it. Unfortunately, you know, Crush was such a weak addition to the team in a lot of ways, so it could have been even a better match as it is, but I always loved it. And yeah, like just the feel-good moment of the ending of it, you know, like and Jim Neidhart laughing maniacally after winning the titles. You know, it's the kind of thing you don't see very often, right? Is, you know, babyface is giving the titles and, you know, and legitimately celebrating, like they're actually happy and they're you know, like it's like they've actually won something, you know, like it's kind of a lost thing,
right?
A lot of ways with wrestling, you know, as opposed to like somebody like dead-eyed Randy Orton who gets the world title and goes home and takes out the garbage and injures his shoulder. You know,
no. Right? Yeah. It's true, though. The tag titles here feel so important.
They do.
Like, they feel like the world title or something in this match.
Yeah.
Like everything's hanging in the balance. And from a kayfabe perspective, taking Meltzer out of it, just this match presented, it's so entertaining.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Extremely entertaining and a great moment. Here's what's not, in my mind, a great moment, and I want to get both of your thoughts on this one. I will start with you, Quinn, but the background, folks. Kurt Hennig was the Intercontinental Champion since April, Mr. Perfect, and he had been set to defend it against Brutus the Barber Beefcake at SummerSlam. Brutus the Barber Beefcake on the 4th of July basically broke his face in a parasailing encounter, and then that's why he was later the man with no face. No. So, as a last-minute replacement, they bring in Kerry Von Erich, who broke off half of his foot in a motorcycle accident.
I was just going to say, the man with no face replaced with the man with no foot.
And Kerry Von Erich came in with this weird Texas Tornado nickname / gimmick. He would be like, I'm a tornado or something.
He's weather.
Yeah, he was weather, which I believe we had a tornado watch up in Saskatoon today, huh, Scott?
Yes, we did. What a bit of happenstance there, yes.
And he debuted, or maybe not debuted, but he was on the Saturday night's main event in July that Scott had referred to with Rick Rude, and I think he beat Buddy Rose or some shit. It didn't matter. And
well, Buddy Rose was in a dark match at this card.
Yes, he was, right?
Shane Douglas.
Yeah, that's not good.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Texas Tornado is the last minute replacement now for Brutus Beefcake. Mr. Perfect, one of the best Intercontinental Champions, you know, ever, probably. But he would be even better if his reign wasn't interrupted here by Kerry Von Erich. I thought it was, I get they had to do what they had to do and you know, compensate for Beefcake not being there and maybe pop some interest or something. But Scott, what do you think of this whole Texas Tornado going over Hennig here?
Well, I mean, the more observer stuff that I go over, the less and less respect I have for Kerry Von Erich, which is really, really kind of sad to learn, you know, all the stuff that he had going on. like that. Originally, it was actually British Bulldog who was supposed to step in and take over for Rufus Beefcake, but they couldn't work out visa issues.
Yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, Bulldog ended up debuting around Survivor Series, I think.
Yeah, right around
somewhere
then.
Somewhere around there. Like, yeah, and his new guy is as Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, rather. Yeah. You know, and tag team us. But yeah, that was actually the way they wanted to go with it, and it fell through. So yeah, they ended up having to get Kerry Von Erich, because basically he was kind of the biggest star that they had left available there. And I mean, Vince always wanted to do something with Kerry Von Erich. I mean, like, he pretty much had coveted him since 84. And part of the reason that he came in was that there was actually a bidding war between WCW and the WWF for him at that point, which is crazy that people would be like fighting over Kerry Von Erich in 1990.
Yeah, seriously.
That is weird.
You know, but I mean, like, the thing is, it's like nobody... He hadn't been on the national stage in such a long time that nobody knew how far he had fallen, essentially. So they brought him in, and, you know, I guess it was a thing where, you know, Brutus Beefcake was out, so they had to put the babyface over to justify it. And again, like, Vince McMahon wanted to give Kerry Von Erich every chance to succeed. I mean, like, you know, you look at him and he looks like a matinee idol, right? So this is, this is the kind of guy that's right up Vince's alley. And, like, it's kind of astonishing that it only took, like, 2 weeks for Vince McMahon to realize what a horrible mistake he had made and then and switch things back again, right? Because pretty much, like, as soon as he got the title, they were like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
What have we done? So, yeah, so they did change that one back there. I think they just wanted to take a shot and, like, you know, see if they could get anything out of him.
It's weird with this because I say this to you all the time.
What?
For whatever reason, I heard through the grapevine or on some WWF thing that, like, Kerry was, like, suicidal or something, and that's how they gave him the title here. And I swear to you, like, now that we're talking about it, I swear I heard this on a WWF like thing.
Oh yeah, they always tell the truth.
Yeah, I'm like on something like about them, like mentioning.
I think
this.
It was more he was suicidal afterwards, and that's why they took the title off him. It wasn't a reason to put a title on him, but basically, like, he won the title, and then he was having trouble with the drugs and he got put on suicide watch and they had to get the title off him immediately.
Right.
Okay. Then that clarifies it for me, because all these years, I've always thought that, like, they were like, give it to him so he just doesn't do
no.
it. Like, yeah, I don't know why. Like, it just, every time I look at this match now, I think of that, like, stray comment on some DVD or something.
As if anyone on a WWE DVD commenting would ever lie.
Yeah.
Was it Steve Lombardi or JBL?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who it was. It was many years ago at this point.
It was not from Steve Lombardi on the DVD.
Yeah, what? Is that his job now?
I think it is, yes.
Just commenting. That's what he does now.
You know, one other thing that's notable at this pay-per-view.
Yes, Quinn.
I will say that I do want to just discuss for a second.
Go ahead.
The whole Sapphire, like, going with the $1 million
oh,
man
good.
Thing.
Yeah. Can you explain that, Quinn?
Yeah. So basically, like, for like a couple weeks, she was like getting like fur coats and like diamond rings and all this. And I just love this because in the midst of this, she's feuding with like Sherry and stuff, and Sherry's telling her, you know, you're a peasant and blah blah blah.
She's not even a person.
Yeah, exactly.
I fail to see what's so funny about a missing person.
I said she was missing. I didn't say anything about her being a person.
So, you know, the pay-per-view comes and they're supposed to have this match, and this is weird because Sherry shows up in like a cat dress or something. Like,
she went from being a witch to being a cat.
Yeah, a cat in high heels about to wrestle for some reason.
Yeah.
Sapphire doesn't show up.
Right.
And then you come to find out that, you know, the $1 million man, just to be an asshole, like, bought Sapphire off just because he hates Dusty Rhodes.
And doesn't she just show her coat or something?
She just, like, she doesn't say anything. She's just kind of, like sashaying all over the screen and, look at my coat. Like, you know, like...
And that's it.
It's just so weird. And $1 million Man's just cackling, like, guy screwed you over. Like, got you real good.
Scott, well, why did they do that?
They just wanted to write Sapphire off, basically. It's...
okay.
Pretty much what it was. Like, they were just done with her, and they're just like, oh, fuck it. We'll just Ted DiBiase, you'll buy her off, and that's it. She'll be off TV.
What's funny is I've watched some of the superstars, like, after this. There's, like, a couple of weeks of promos that you could tell were all filmed
taped
at the same time.
Yeah.
Like her just, like, standing by him, and he's like, I hate you, Dusty Rhodes. Like, it's, like, so weird.
You know what's also weird? Before we leave SummerSlam 90, tying in with that, is Savage squashes the shit out of Dusty Rhodes in like 2 minutes at that pay-per-view.
Oh yeah, right. Writing was on the wall at that point for Dusty Rhodes, let me tell you.
Damn, that's like...
Yeah, that was like the Ric Flair, you know, like the Ric Flair retirement tour that he did where, you know, like he had to win or else he'd retire.
Yeah.
Except it was the opposite for Dusty Rhodes. It was like Vince is like, you're going to lose every fucking match, and then I'm going to upset your retirement. It's pretty much the way that it ended up at that point. He wanted out of the Dusty Rhodes relationship, really. So he was pretty much trying to drive him out of the promotion.
It worked.
I will say this, you know, to me, as a kid watching this, like, on tape or whatever, it always came off to me like, I guess Dusty's just sad about losing Sapphire, so he's distracted. And that's why they played it off as. Yeah, so I fell for it. But. Yeah,
well, it was very interesting to say the least. Let's move on to 91 now, folks. And we are once again back at Madison Square Garden. And we have some very interesting double main event this time. We have the match made in heaven, which was a wedding that wasn't a real wedding because they were already married, of Savage and Elizabeth. And we have the match made in hell, and that's the one I want to focus on.
Yeah, it was from hell, all right.
It was from hell. Scott, I made this point on Monday's show with Quinn. We were talking about the worst SummerSlam main events. The reason this match means nothing to me now, or when I first saw it, or in any time I've ever looked at it, is because Hogan had already beaten Slaughter not only at WrestleMania, but probably at a ton of house shows, and also at the Desert Storm match that was televised from MSG. Warrior had, I think, beaten Slaughter. Maybe, obviously, I know the Rumble, but Warrior, I think, had beaten him at some point. Maybe not. But then also in the match is fucking the Iron Sheik in 1991. and General Adnan. So was this, Scott, kind of the definition of like a filler main event? Did they have other plans? Did they have no plans? What happened here?
There's rumors of doing Warrior against Hogan for a while there, and then there's, it's all very muddied. A lot of it is based on things that Warrior said after the fact and legal depositions and stuff. But I guess the idea that Warrior was pushing was that Vince wanted him to turn heel and face Hogan either here or at WrestleMania. Warrior kept refusing and led to the whole boondoggle with the payoff where Warrior held up Vince for the money and then left promotion and Vince sending him the best passive aggressive fridge note in history.
Yes, I've seen that.
You've seen that? Isn't that is you can say many things about Vince McMahon, but he has many redeeming fat qualities and that was one of them. That was like the ballsiest thing that I've ever seen. But I do want to say overall, I love the pay-per-view. Like SummerSlam 91, it's like one of my all-time favorite shows. But yeah, god damn, that main event is just terrible. Ugh.
It's interesting that such an awkward main event is the main event of such a fantastic pay-per-view overall. And I do want to say also, here was something I totally forgot about until just now. Do you remember the referee in that match? That main event.
Sid.
Yeah.
Good point. I forgot about that too. Now, why did he have a non-wrestle contract or something?
He had a non-compete contract. Yes. So Sid was actually not able to get into the ring until around October, I think it was, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. He was absolutely barred from being in the ring, and they were skirting on very dangerous legal ground with Turner as it is. Using him as a referee, but I mean, you know, like that's how Vince rolls, right? So
that's how Vince rolls.
So yeah, he would have been in the ring like immediately if he could. Like that was
right.
Vince wanted him out there to be his top guy, like no question about it.
Makes sense,
because it would have made sense to make him the partner, the third guy,
or something. Right. Yeah, just something interesting.
Because I never understood why.
There you go.
Yeah, I never understood why this was a handicap match. Like that's the thing that always boggled me.
At the time, as you know, when I was watching as a fan who didn't really know anything, because I was still a couple of years away from being online, when they were going to introduce Colonel Mustafa, I thought that was going to be Sid. I thought, you know, because you knew Sid was coming in, like from you know, like reading the wrestling magazines and like that, and it's like it seemed like a logical position for him to be coming in, teaming up as, you know, like the lead heel, right?
Right.
Against Hulk Hogan. And then it was like, it's the Iron Sheik. And it's like, holy shit, what a letdown that was. Let me tell you.
Yeah. Overall, a very awkward main event. You know, I think you said that right, Quinn.
Yeah.
Just awkward.
Just weird.
Fantastic moment, though, is Bret Hart winning his first singles title against Kurt Hennig. Not the best match they've ever had, obviously. They had better before and after.
Mm-hmm.
But a nice moment just to see Bret finally win.
Yeah.
Dude, tell us exactly what you think about yourself. It's wonderful. Well, there you go.
And doubly amazing, too, because Kurt Hennig's back was just a wreck, right? He actually had not been in the ring for about a month and a half prior to that match, right? Like, he had to miss all the TV tapings because he just couldn't even get out of bed, basically. And it was pretty amazing that he even got out there and got that match out of him.
Yeah, and I always didn't like that John Tolos was with him, because that was
Coach.
Annoying.
Coach was useless, yes.
Yeah, useless.
John Tolos is a fabulous wrestler, but he's, as a manager, no, not so much.
I know. I always wish Bobby could have just hung on for two more months and managed perfect.
It wasn't
up till that match, yeah. You know, hindsight being what it is.
It's funny, though, this pay-per-view, you know, you look up and down the card.
Uh-huh.
This has to be like, you know how we were saying SummerSlam was always has like a feel-good moment?
Oh, there's
this
so many.
This card has like
faces win.
Four feel-good moments, like tons of them, like DiBiase and Virgil and the whole Mountie in jail, like all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like the Legion of Doom, even though I don't like them, yep, but like that's their big crowning moment. Like this is just one thing after another.
This is the faces win show, is it not?
Yes. No yes, doubt about it.
If the faces win, the bad guy gets anally raped in prison. I mean, you know, it's got every feel-good moment that you could want, right?
For the whole family.
For the whole family.
That whole prison thing is,
yeah,
it is like, I love that.
Oh,
like,
Jacques Rougeau is.
The fact that it goes on as the show goes on, yeah. I always love that.
You can't do this to me! You know who I am!
Come on. Come
you
on,
can't
on.
Do this to me! Ow! Oh, you can't do that! Oh! You stop! You stupid! You know who I am? I'm the Mountie!
And I guess it's funny because, like, in the Observer at the time, right, Dave was actually at the show live, and they didn't get any of the prison stuff on like, a big screen or anything like that, right? So,
right.
So he was just like, oh, yeah, no, the Mountie lost the match. It was really weird. He just got squashed, and that didn't lead to anything. And then, you know, later on, of course, then he found out, you know, he watched the tape and saw all the stuff that was happening there. But, yeah, obviously, that's the kind of thing. It's kind of gags that you obviously cannot do today.
Right. Oh, no.
You know, definitely not.
No.
But yeah, I mean, as a show, God, yeah, like it was like baby faces winning up and down, and you know, all these wonderful feel good moments, and yeah, I was kind of bummed. I was actually away at like a writer's retreat for that. And it happened to be the weekend of SummerSlam, and I was like, oh shit, this is where Bret Hart's going to win the Intercontinental title, right? You know, I was really bummed, but you know, I ended up watching the tape a million times after I got back, but yeah, that was a rough one to miss.
It's no wonder that's one of your favorites and one of mine too, and one of Quinn's, because the faces win. Who would have thought?
Yeah. And there's one other thing on this pay-per-view.
Go ahead.
Sorry,
Quinn.
One more note.
Go ahead,
I just
go
want, because that there's a lot of things I like about this pay-per-view.
Sure.
But the other thing is the whole Bobby with the world belt,
yes,
and Hogan slams the door on him.
Yes.
And then he
yes.
comes back and Gorilla makes a remark about green on his fingers and all this. Oh, I love that stuff.
Hey, Boobs!
Boy, nice job you did out there in the hallway.
How'd it go there, Bob?
Hey, I'll tell you something. You look good.
Ric Flair would have knocked on that door. Hogan would have dropped to his knees, surrendered the World Wrestling Federation
Where
title.
You be serious?
He took a cheap shot at me. He didn't want to match wits with me. He didn't want to even talk to me. He's trying. If he thinks he embarrassed me, he's dead wrong. Nobody embarrasses me.
So I would assume, Scott, that they knew they had Flair coming in by this point. If they had the belt, he must have been the one to give it to him, no?
Yes, but Flair had not actually signed his contract at that point. So they were treading on some very shaky legal ground there, too, in fact.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. They were forbidden from specifically mentioning the NWA world title.
Understood, yeah.
For obvious legal reasons. But yeah, but like, say, Flair had not actually signed a contract. So in theory, after that, he could have went back to WCW and actually re-signed a contract. And in fact, they were trying to. Like, they were doing, like, literally up until the moment the Flair debut, Turner was doing, like, kind of round-the-clock emergency negotiations with Flair, trying to get him to, you know,
wow,
pull back at the 11th hour and, you know, not do this. But it was a great moment for the time, and of course, they completely botched it. But, you know, you know, at the time, though, my God, like, you know, seeing the NWA World title turn up on the WWF pay-per-view was...
That was
makes
crazy.
Your head explode. That was crazy.
Yeah,
that was a pretty big deal. Let's hop the pond now for 1992 as we go to England, Wembley. We've got some very interesting things going on here. First of all, over 80,000 fans is the announced attendance. This is one of my personal favorite pay-per-views. I love 1991 as well. I really love 92, and here's two reasons. The first one is, I know, Quinn, you're not as big a fan of this match as I am, and
Okay.
I'll let you answer to it, and then we'll see what Scott thinks. Savage Warrior 2. I know the retirement match from WrestleMania 7 is their big one, their well-known one. I really like this face versus face, but they're mad at each other, and you got Flair and Perfect being assholes. I really like Savage Warrior 2 for the world title at SummerSlam 92. Quinn, real quick.
Here's my issue with the match. The problem with all of this is the whole Ric Flair situation, and the fact that he's there, but he's not there. That just drove me nuts. That he didn't wrestle. Yeah, and I understand that he's like screwing with them, but could he have done something else at this pay-per-view? I mean, it feels like this is part of with me and how sometimes I feel like they didn't get the full potential out of having Ric Flair. It's like you have this big SummerSlam, like, outside and stuff, and he's not even wrestling.
Well, I always say, who would he have fought?
I know, you know? I understand that, but it's positioned in this way where it's just weird. I don't know.
I understand.
What does Scott think of it?
Well, I mean, to say that they didn't use Ric Flair to his full potential would be quite the understatement, I'm sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You could throw him in there against, like, I don't know, like Big Boss Man or something like that, maybe? I can't remember who was...
That's fair.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't know. I can't remember what he was doing at the time.
He was dead. Nails killed him.
Oh, he was dead. Okay. Yeah, well, that would be problematic, I guess, but I really like Savage Warrior. I thought it was like a 4-star match, actually. I mean,
yeah.
It was,
no, I didn't have a problem with the match.
You just don't like the Flair is doing that instead of wrestling
yeah,
at all?
The situation's odd. I don't know. It's just strange.
Yeah, no, I can understand that, yeah.
Yeah, no, I get it too. But overall, as a match, it's intense. It's totally different than the WrestleMania 7 match too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
different story being told, right? Different in the ring, and obviously the distraction of Flair and Perfect make it a little bit more fun. And of course, Bret Hart versus the British Bulldog is the other reason I love this pay per view. I mean, there's other reasons, but Bret Bulldog is a great match. It's Bret says it's his best match ever. Like we talked about Monday Quinn, it's not Bret's best match, but
that would be WrestleMania 10.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. But overall, I mean, you want to talk about feel-good moments for at least the hometown crowd, if no one else.
Yeah.
I don't like to see Bret lose. Scott, what do you think of that match overall?
I mean, I love the match, obviously. I would have issues with saying that it's Bret's best match ever because Davey Boy was, you know, whatever his issue was. I don't want, you know, I mean, he's dead now, so it doesn't really matter what accusations we throw at him. But, I mean, Bret has basically said that he was... I can't remember what
smoking crack.
Yeah, there you go, smoking crack before the yes. And he was essentially a walking mannequin that Bret had to wrestle the entire match by himself. So that's fine. Obviously, Bret then would consider that to be his best match. I'm sure.
Yeah, because he wrestled himself.
Because he wrestled himself. Yeah, it's 3-1. It wasn't like Bulldog wasn't even supposed to be involved in the match, right? Like when SummerSlam was announced for Landover, Maryland, it was going to be Bret Hart against Shawn Michaels in the ladder match, and that's
that
how
would
they
be
were
great.
Yeah, right. So that's how they were going to get the title onto Shawn Michaels. And like when they moved to England, they were just like, oh, okay, well, there we go. Bulldog can be a transitional champion then for a month.
Right. So there was never a plan to make him anything other than the guy that lost to Shawn Michaels.
Oh, no, definitely not. Shawn, they were full on the Shawn train at that point.
You know, you guys talking about the him being on drugs or something.
Yeah.
Here. I guess that kid at the beginning said the British Bulldog's going to win whether he wants to or not.
The British Bulldog's going to win. Whether he wants to or not,
I guess it didn't matter what he wanted. It all makes sense now, huh?
Yes, exactly. It was a weird dynamic too, because you know Bret Hart was trying to get out of his contract and go to WCW as well.
As always,
yeah.
As always, usual. Yeah. Like, it's like he finally got what he wanted in 1997, right? But
yeah.
Yeah, but it's, you know, because everybody think, you know, the thinking of the time was, okay, well, Bret's going to lose and then, you know, go to WCW and then end up being off in the totally different direction for his career, right? Which was an interesting twist.
Yeah, winning the world title and sticking around for five more years. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Although I think a better finish for the match in Wembley Stadium would have been British Bulldog dedicates the match to his dying sister and then Bret Hart beats him anyway. they should workshop that one, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
At least Bret didn't lose his smile.
Yeah, exactly.
We're making fun of Shawn Michaels, if you can't tell.
Yeah, oh, I got you. I got you.
I got a couple things to hit on 92 again.
Oh, go ahead.
Go to, yep. Yeah, sure. Okay, so like there was a lot of other weird stuff going on too, because I mean, it was also the last appearance of the Legion of Doom for like 5 years.
Yep.
Before they returned in
97, so that was kind of a historic thing, you know, with Rocco the Dummy.
Oh, God.
They were in another situation in 92 as well, because they were actually both at WrestleMania and at SummerSlam. They were supposed to be challenging for the tag team titles against Money Incorporated, and both times the title match got changed on them.
That's funny.
Yeah, I know. It's just such a weird. It was a weird set of circumstances around them at the time, and then of course Hawk showed up, and you know he was in. It didn't matter whether he was being told he was winning or losing, right? He was not losing. Yeah, and then basically he wanted to go off and be with the Hells Angels and you know shoot monkey steroids or whatever the hell he was. Doing that point, right? So
good for yeah. I don't know if Rocco was the dummy.
I don't know, but if you ever research the life of Michael Hegstrand, holy crap! Like he was into some crazy stuff. You know, the band was on steroids at that point, right? And he was on suspension. So what he did, he would literally source like hormones that were taken out of horses and monkeys, and mutes amplifies steroids, right? Like, so
disgusting.
I know. Anyway, so I just wanted to talk about that.
Thanks for that bright spot there,
Thanks, Scott.
No problem. On to 1993.
Okay. Yeah, because this 92, yeah. it's weird. I say
we all hop on to the Lex Express now.
That's because, so
because, folks, in 1993 at the Palace of Auburn Hills in suburban Detroit, Michigan, we had Lex Luger, now an All-American hero, because, Quinn, what did Lex Luger do? He defended America's honor by picking up a big fat guy.
Yep, on a boat. Don't forget the boat part.
So, of course, he's the natural candidate to fight Yokozuna because he picked him up.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I always determine who I'm going to fight. You know, if I can pick him up, that's it. I'm better than them.
You got it.
Pretty much, you know, Vince was like, well, we need another blonde guy who's muscular. So there's this guy over here. He looks like, kind of like Hulk.
Yeah, Crush.
Yeah, Crush. Yeah, exactly.
You know, something before we get started with this pay-per-view, because I'm just thinking about it overall.
Go ahead.
Boy, has this place changed in a year, huh?
What?
I mean, you just look at this card and you just, even the way it feels, like everything about this is, like, to me, a huge transition compared to the last year.
This is the early warning stages of the new generation, right? I mean, this is what was to come.
Yeah, the new generation, the AKA, they fired everybody from 1992 and had to replace with all these scrubs. I mean, that's pretty much what it was, right? It was cost-cutting.
And for some reason, they relegate Macho Man to commentary and shit like that.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Exactly. And ridiculous.
He could still go, too.
Yeah.
But the Lex Express finally made its stop at SummerSlam 93 as the evil, horrible, terrible foreign champion, Yokozuna. Not to mention the previous champion before Hogan, Quinn, was Bret Hart, and he was Canadian, so...
Yeah, I don't know... Foreign. Why do we not have to defend America's honor there?
I don't know. I don't get what that's all about.
And why couldn't we just accept that, you know what? Maybe it's a world championship and that other people can, you know, it doesn't always have to be American people.
It's true. But it was, and it was Lex Luger. And they had this big, you know, hugely hyped match. And I'm assuming, Scott, the finish was Luger defeated Yoko by count out and celebrated like a... With, like, the Steiners, I think, and Tatanka, like a big idiot.
Yeah, he's like balloons.
Yay,
coming
I
down.
Won!
Yeah, I won my countout. Yeah, I know.
Scott, Quinn and I were talking on Monday about this match, actually. Was the plan here that you know of to actually build to a further blow off, like WrestleMania 10, for example, and have Luger finally win it, or were they done with Luger?
No, the plan was definitely to build to WrestleMania.
Okay.
Although the funny thing, that was not originally the plan. The original plan was just to get the belt the hell onto Lex Luger. And hopefully save the house show business.
Really?
And then, and then as they got closer on the Lex Express, then they thought, well, let's press our luck and see if we can stretch this out to WrestleMania after that.
They made it to about Survivor Series time, and then that was over. I mean,
yeah.
Personally, I think they should have just said, fuck it, and had Luger win the title on the U.S. has to drop it, right?
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, just do a repeat of the WrestleMania thing, right? Have, you know, Yokozuna throw an open challenge, and Luger comes out and slams him and pins him.
Fuck
He's the champion, and off you go.
That would have been better, I think.
Yeah.
I
mean,
that because people would have been excited at the very least, because they were hyping the shit that out of this happening, basically.
Right.
Like, we just saw the TV.
Luger just wasn't Hulk Hogan. There's just no way around it, and what they wanted was a Hogan.
Yeah, but if they had hit us, like, just slapped us in the face with it,
rather than
just, like
they did with Diesel,
introduce it.
Like Diesel.
They might have gotten away with it this time,
because
though.
It would have been a surprise win instead of, like, this fucking bus tour, like he's Jimmy Carter or something.
Yeah. Was he run for president?
Exactly. There's also a random Ludwig Borga match, and I'm bringing that up for two reasons. Number one is because there's a promo right before Borga squashes Marty Jannetty. There's a promo before that Quinn and I love. He's walking next to some dilapidated building in Detroit, and he gives Quinn and I one of our favorite lines that we play all the time on the show.
America is crumbling.
America is crumbling.
Because I guess he was an environmentalist.
Yeah, it's so weird, right?
He was. Really, that was the idea.
He
was the precursor to global warming or something.
Well, they wanted him to be a neo-Nazi, but then they were like, well, we can't do that, I guess. So I guess that's like he's an environmentalist instead, right? Because
everyone hates them.
Yeah. Which is so funny. Luger was supposed to get the title, and then, you know, like, Borga was going to get title shots, right? That's why they're giving him that huge push.
Good God.
For SummerSlam, right? And it's like,
yeah.
That was going to be the house show run.
But if Luger doesn't beat Yoko here, then what is the point of Borga?
Exactly.
There you go.
So stupid.
Yes.
Exactly. And
you understand. That's right. What is the point of Borga?
We can never figure it out.
We can never figure it out. The only thing I could say is that he's somewhat of a precursor to Brock Lesnar in terms of like
look
maybe, but like
kind of fatter though.
And more dead.
Yeah.
So let's move on to another match I want to mention real quick. Shawn Michaels defends the Intercontinental title here against Mr. Perfect in what the WWF basically, not with saying it, but saying it without saying it, that this was going to be a classic. This is going to be Savage Steamboat, right?
They pretty much said it. Yeah, there was no skirting around it. They were like, yeah, this is going to be a classic 4.5-star match. You know, get your observer out and get ready to send in the letters to Dave Meltzer and, you know, send in the star ratings and all that. Yeah, it was weird. That was one of the first matches I can ever remember them really doing that tactic with. Coming out and saying beforehand, you know, like, you know, this is rather than promoting like any kind of hatred or feud between them, they're basically saying, yeah, this is going to be a classic match, right? Like, you know, they're going to put on a performance for you, you know, and all that.
Ooh, yeah, performance, know, right.
Bullshit. Yeah, talk to you now, right?
Why was this book this way then?
You know, that's a fine question. That's like, why? That is the thing, right? Like, why would they think it was going to be, you know, why would they promote it as a classic match and then be like, okay, so Shawn Michaels wins by count out when we have Diesel interfere and some bullshit finish, right? Like, you know, like,
what the hell is that?
Who does that? Like,
in 11 minutes, no less.
In 11 minutes, yeah. It was really weird. But I mean, like, I guess, you know, Shawn Michaels was on a reasonable hot streak before that, right? Like, he was having great matches with Marty Jannetty, and, you know, Diesel was turning into a hot character. So it's like, it's kind of understandable they thought they had something with it, but it's just like, I don't know, Shawn Michaels and Mr. Perfect just never clicked for some reason. I don't know. Some people just don't have great chemistry together, no matter if they're great workers.
That's
but I mean,
true.
The thing is that they're very similar as workers. It's a thing, right? So it's part of a reason that's a bit of a style clash there is, right? They both want to be the one that goes out, you know, and does this, and, you know, and sells and takes the big bumps and everything like that, right?
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. You know, you need somebody to go out there and take the lead on it, right? If they had Bret Hart in that match, 5-star class.
Yeah,
with either of them.
That's right, yeah.
Quinn, anything you want to say about SummerSlam 93 before we move on to a great one?
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
It's a good card.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It just feels like a regression and a decline.
From 92 and 91,
you look at
yes.
some of the stuff on here, like... I remember the opening match, and that I always felt like sad about DiBiase at the beginning.
Oh, he was on his way out.
Yeah, and like you just look at a lot of the matches here: IRS versus 1-2-3 Kid.
Not a bad.
Yeah. I think it would have been saved somewhat if they had done the original idea of having Money Incorporated against 1-2-3 Kid and Razor Ramon.
That would have been nice.
That would have been better.
That would have been better than the way they went with it.
Absolutely, that would have been a hot opener, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. It was a strange decision to break them up like that.
It was.
And then you got the Taker versus Gonzalez thing.
That's horrible. Yeah. I can't
justify that. I mean, there's
that.
Just a lot of junk but on
the,
here.
To this day, we still don't know what a Rest in Peace match is, by the way.
Yeah. What? I do have to say, though, I do like when Paul Bearer clotheslines Harvey Whippleman. That is funny. It just is a little like one-off moment where Bobby's like, oh, Harvey will knock you out, and then Paul Bearer just clotheslines him, and that's it. It's pretty funny.
But there is a reason why, to me, this is my least rewatched
93, really?
Yeah, I hate this show. Like, come I really
on,
don't
man.
Like it.
The whole Bret Hart angle.
Oh, we didn't even talk about the Bret Hart thing. God, bus full of nuns and orphans. Come
yes,
on.
Exactly. The fiery wreck.
Yes.
The whole King crawled speech. Out of I know.
And he heroically goes to the arena and sends his court jester.
What happened? I'm going to tell you what happened if you shut up. The radio didn't work. The brakes didn't work. The airbag didn't work, and as I was pulling off I-75 out here, a little old blue-haired lady who should have had her license revoked about 50 years ago pulled out in front of me, and she caused about a 10-car pileup.
Must have been Helen Hart.
Wonderful.
It's great.
It was great. It was legitimately like a whole 4-star deal. It was amazing.
I agree with you 100%, Scott. That's such a wonderful angle. All right. Let's go to
enough of this pay-per-view.
Let's go to the brand new United Center in Chicago, Illinois for SummerSlam 94. So I was very excited for what wasn't actually the main event, and that would be the Bret Hart Owen Hart steel cage match for the world title. I love this match. Even though there's no blood and it's not as you know, violent as maybe like a steel cage match would be. I think it's a fantastic match, a fantastic angle with the guy, with all the Hart family trying to run in at the end, and Bulldog finally makes a save. Quinn, we'll start with you. What do you think of that match?
You said it. It just, it has a big feel to it, you know, like just like how you were like hyped for it. I mean, you know, and I don't know. I think it's the perfect blow off to the feud.
It really was.
They would,
yeah,
you know, kind of linger feud for a while until the Hart Foundation formed in 97. But yeah, it's fantastic. And I know Brett's told stories about, oh, it was so safe coming off the thing. You know how he always goes on and on about that. Yeah. So I have nothing really bad to say about it.
When I remember suplexing Owen off the top of the cage into the ring, standing off the top, that's a long ways down. And when I think about Owen, especially in how things ended for him, and I remember that. Just how important it was for me to protect him as we fell back into the ring.
I mean, it's just a great match.
What do you think, Scott?
I think clearly it's one of the, within the confines of the shitty WWE big blue steel cage format, you know, that was pretty much the best they were going to get out of it. And of course, they were treading a very fine line of sponsors at that point. And, you know, they couldn't do anything super violent and they couldn't do blood and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a fantastic match. I gave it 5 stars personally. I've always loved it. I mean, yeah, it's like, it's super entertaining. You know, set up some great stuff with British Bulldog making his surprise comeback at the end there. Well, escaping WCW.
Good.
Just in time. Right?
So, yeah, really, just in chat from Cheatham the Evil Midget.
Cheatham the Evil Midget, yeah. Exactly.
You know, SummerSlam 94 also has a very, again, maybe underappreciated is the best word, Razor Ramon Diesel match for the Intercontinental title. I like that match a lot.
I like that match too. Although Walter Payton is in Razor Ramon's corner.
Hey, I mean, it made sense. It was in Chicago. He was on the Bears. It wasn't like, you know, I mean, it made sense for the local crowd.
It is just, I did like that match a lot too, though.
Yeah.
I think this has, it highlights a lot of the good stuff of 94.
Yes.
With those things.
With Bret Owen, Razor Diesel.
Even the Bull Nakano thing.
Oh, you know what? That is a great match. Bull Nakano versus Alondra Scott. Remember that one?
Actually, that was another good match. 94 had some pretty good stuff on it, I have to say. Bull Nakano came across as such a, you know, challenger of the week type of thing, right? It was, you know, unfortunately, there wasn't really much of a women's division at that point. It was mostly, you know, Alondra loses the title and then wins it back in the inspirational thing. Set up the next thing and blah, 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 right? But I mean, like, yeah, it was fine. That was a good match. I really, really liked the Diesel Razor Ramon match. Really put me on the Kevin Nash train for a while there. Like, you know, he was.
Yeah.
It's well done.
It set it up well. It is very well done. I will unironically say that I was a huge fan of Diesel for, you know, much of 1994. I was all on board with him winning the world title at that point. And that match was a big match for reason why. Odd Shawn Michaels took such a backseat to it. But I mean, that's how much he wanted his buddy to, you know, succeed, right? Like he stepped back from the role, right? And let him.
It was
really weird that they won the tag team titles and then didn't defend them on the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
That was kind of a strange dynamic that they had going on there at that point.
Were they just pulling the titles off of the head shrinkers to be safe because Samu was leaving or something like that?
Yeah, I've never been really sure. Like, unless it was just a thing where they wanted, you know, they just wanted to give the mega push to Diesel and Shawn and, you know, one of the champions. But that was a weird period.
That whole situation's weird with Shawn taking. I never could understand.
He just took some time off from wrestling.
Yeah, as a Shawn Michaels fan, I just could never understand why this guy, who he's clearly more talented than, like, why he would just do this.
Because Diesel was more marketable at the time, probably, more pushable, and it's still just larger than life.
It's always baffled me. I that's my personal opinion on it.
I understand.
And I get it that it's his friend and stuff, but it just seems odd to me, that's all.
I don't know. It worked out fine for Shawn in the end. Can we talk about the main event? And maybe this will be the last time I ever talk about this again.
There was another main event? What? No, it was just a cage match, right? And then the show ended.
Yeah, you're right, Scott. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so we can move on.
No, well, yeah. Leslie Nielsen was looking for this main event the whole show, remember?
Yeah, and not to rehash the angle so much, so let me just make this very brief for everyone listening at home. The Undertaker died at Royal Rumble 94, went up to the heavens and turned into Marty Jannetty in a costume.
Yep.
He was not heard from for many, many months. Then in the summer, right around the time that SummerSlam began to get promoted, Ted DiBiase was like, ah, ha, 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 I found the Undertaker, ha, ha, ha. So he brings him out to the Heartbreak Hotel, and it's not the Undertaker, but everyone acts like it's the Undertaker.
Right.
Then Paul Bearer is somewhere in the middle of a field that they say is a graveyard or something. And he's like, no, it's not true. I'll bring the real Undertaker. And then they were going to fight at the SummerSlam. And the Undertaker came out and he had purple on this time. And the fake Undertaker had the gray. And the urn was really big. And it was a flashlight now. And the match was really terrible. And the Underfaker was primetime Brian Lee. And he retained that dark hair all the way until he was chains. And it's a really bad match. And the Undertaker wore purple. And what I want to know is...
Wait, so the Undertaker wore purple, you're saying? Yes.
Yeah, he was purple. And what I want to know, Scott, is do you know any... like? Okay, like, why did they do this? That's the only way I can ask.
Boy, you want to know, like, the meaning of life and, like, any other tough questions as well now? See, this one was such a weird... Yeah.
That's such a gee-golly question.
Yeah. Who killed Kennedy and why did they do this match? Yeah.
No, but it's like, it was such a weird thing, too, because it's like, even within, you know, the suspend your disbelief oddity of wrestling that we usually accept,
right?
It's like... Ted DiBiase brings out this guy who is clearly not the Undertaker. And all the announcers are like, oh, shit, it's the Undertaker. He's back from the dead, right? It's like, whereas any rational person would be like, well, this is clearly he's paid some guy to, like, to pretend to be the Undertaker, and then the real Undertaker will come back and beat him. But no, that's not what they did at all. They're like, well, it's the Undertaker, and oh my God, there's a second Undertaker, and the two Undertakers are going to fight. It'll be like Time Cop, where you touch your former self, and the universe will explode, right? And it's like, well, why couldn't they just do it the way that makes sense and just be like, oh man, Ted DiBiase, he's full of shit. This guy's clearly, you know, like, that would have at least been a build that was at least a little bit sensible, because then there's some heat behind it. As it was, though, it's like, are we supposed to not believe Ted DiBiase? Are we supposed to believe Ted DiBiase? Like,
until later?
You see the science here behind the split of the Undertaker? You know, like, I don't get it.
Why did this taker not wear green gloves, by the way? I'd just throw that out
there.
That
would be obvious, Quinn.
Were they trying?
Never mind the fact that he was 6'4".
Why were they trying? The cover story. They don't want to blow the cover story.
But why did the other Undertaker know to wear purple?
There's so many questions.
Yeah, and you know what? We're going to have more questions and more answers, hopefully, from Scott Keith later. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, folks, the New Generation era is in full force and Bret Hart fights a dentist. Back after this.
From Harley Race to Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair to The Rock, Sting to Steve Austin, you're listening to our Vantage Point, the Retro Wrestling Podcast.
He was taken away in his prime and won where no other man has been. Now, he has returned. Monday night, August 29th, Domino's Pizza delivers SummerSlam, a live World Wrestling Federation pay-per-view event. So hot, it's scary.
I will not rest in peace.
Hey, it's Sean Mooney. I may no longer be in the event center, but if I was, I'd be talking about our Vantage Point Retro Wrestling Podcast. All right, boys, let's get to it.
And welcome back, wrestling fans, to our Vantage Point, the SummerSlam Spectacular.
The SummerSlam.
The SummerSlam. We have been talking, of course, with the number one Zeus fan, Scott Keith. How you doing there, Scotty?
Zeusing it up over here, you betcha.
And folks, at any time, of course, you can let us know your SummerSlam memories by reaching us on Twitter at OVP Podcast. You can email us at OVPPodcast@gmail.com. And you can, of course, if you haven't yet, go to the Facebook group and talk there. Even Scott will respond if you have an important question. I asked him one recently. Scott will do his best to get to you.
I do my best, yes.
We will now resume our SummerSlam run through here. The New Generation era is in full effect here. We have Diesel, who has been the champion now since November of 1994. He is fighting in the main event, King Mabel.
With Sir Mo, don't forget.
With Sir Mo, yes. Sir Mo, is at hand, of course. And please don't forget the least important wrestler ever. Scott, another blunt question for you. Why? Why Diesel versus Mabel?
Well, they need, because Diesel was Hogan in their eyes, and they needed a big fat heel for him to vanquish, and Mabel was the biggest and fattest, so, you know, that's... Why not, right?
I guess. I mean, you know what? I'll give him credit. The actual wrestling match is a little bit better than you would think it would be.
Oh, a little bit, but Mabel nearly killed Kevin Nash during the match, so...
Yeah, what was the spot where that happened? I've heard of that.
Yeah, well, Kevin had a bad back, right? And so he was like, okay, take it easy on me before the match, right? So they're doing a rear chin lock spot, and then Mabel sits on his back with the full force of his ass and basically throws his back out. And you can actually, if you watch on the videotape, he's like, what the fuck, man? And, he's just like, and so actually, and then actually after the match, Mabel went back to the dressing room and Vince fired him on the spot.
He did.
You know, really? Yeah. You can insert like a Vince, you're fired in here if you want to with your editing brows.
You're fired!
And then, and basically, yeah, Diesel saved his job and you know, and asked him for another chance. And then, of course, 2 months later, he then went and injured The Undertaker, and there ain't no coming back from that.
No, you don't injure The Undertaker.
You don't mess with The Undertaker, yeah.
He's already been killed the year before. He doesn't need this shit.
Well, ironically, he would come back as The Undertaker's crony as Viscera.
Yeah, that's a way to bring it back, Quinn.
Yeah,
very
there
good.
You go.
But also at this event here, I alluded to it earlier, Bret Hart, because they knew how to use him in 95, he was fighting Big Daddy Dentist.
Yeah.
One of Scott's lines there. Fake Diesel himself, Kane.
Yep.
But this is his Isaac Yankum guys. I guess he had just graduated, you know, dentistry school. So he was a dentist at this point, and he was Jerry Lawler's dentist. He fixed Jerry Lawler's teeth from the Smelly Foot incident of King of the Ring. So, of course, his dentist happens to be a wrestler, and Bret Hart fought him. This sucked, and it's a testament to Bret Hart's ability as a wrestler, like, in the ring. Say what you want about him as a person, but as a wrestler, man, he still tried his ass off, but I just felt so bad. Quinn, what do you think of that whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it pretty much encapsulates 1995 to me. I mean, this is some of the prime stuff you think about when you think about the awfulness of this year.
Right.
This whole, why is Bret fighting a dentist?
You have Bret, like, Hart!
I mean, like, even looking on this card, I'm not saying we have to go through any of these matches, but, like, Barry Horowitz on SummerSlam? Like, what? And like, Bertha Fay? Like, I'm just, you look at this card... And, you know, going back to the dentist stuff, it's just what it was. Like, it's just what this year was.
Scott, what do you know about that whole scenario there with Bret versus Isaac Yankum?
I mean, they're basically trying to keep Bret around and doing stuff until they can get the world title on him again, really. But, I mean, I mean, like, they really liked Glenn Jacobs, obviously. Like, they kept trying to find a spot for him, right? Like, you know, they gave him all these tryout matches, and then they gave him the dentist gimmick. And, I mean, it's a solid idea in theory.
I guess.
Sort of.
A dentist, right? And, you know, like, he's an evil dentist. He likes to drill people's teeth, right? So, you know, like, it's an easy character to get your head around, you know? Like, it's pretty obvious who you're going to boo when you come out there.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing for, like, a third from the top heel to be doing, right? Like, it's, you know, it's a wrestling dentist. Like, well, if he's that successful a dentist, why is he wrestling? I mean, he can make way more money than a dentist, you know? Never understood that.
And how does he happen to be from Decatur? I don't know. No one likes a dentist, though. That's a good point. Who likes the dentist? I mean, it makes total sense. Quinn, you don't like the dentist.
I don't like the dentist, but, you know, you got to make an appointment sometimes.
Are you an anti-dentite?
I'm not an anti-dentite, just for the record.
I am not an anti-dentite.
You're a rabid anti-dentite.
I'm afraid.
Okay.
I'll admit it.
Well, I'll say this. The match and the angle was like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
Thank you.
<Did it.
laughs> And, you know, an interesting match here. Razor Ramon challenging this time for the Intercontinental title against Shawn Michaels, the incumbent Intercontinental champion. Is this true, Scott? They booked this match. It was originally supposed to be Shawn versus Sid. They booked it because they realized the card sucked.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Although it's really the other really wacky thing about that match is that the sponsors came to Vince before the match and said we don't want the ladder used as a weapon. So one of the things was that Vince had to tone down the violence a lot.
Really?
So the sponsors came to Vince with the specific demand that the ladder not be used as a weapon in the match. So if you actually watch the match, which, by the way, in a lot of ways I consider to be the equal of the WrestleMania match. It was a fantastic match, but at no point does one person hit the other person with the ladder?
Weird.
It's weird.
I don't remember it that way.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's how well constructed it was. It's like Alfred Hitchcock doing the violence off screen, right? Mm-hmm. Like everything's applied. The most violent thing that happens in the match is at one point, I think Razor or Sean pushes the ladder over and it falls on the other person, but it's not. It was never directly used as a weapon. They can put it in the corner, for instance, and whip the other guy into it.
Right.
Right. So in that case, then the ladder happens to be in the way of an offensive move.
It's incidental.
It's incidental. But yeah, no, if you watch the match, at no point is the ladder used as a striking weapon, which kind of blew my mind that they were still able to get like a 5-star match out of it, mm-hmm. given those kind of confines on it. But, I mean, obviously it was a great decision to switch from the Sean Sid match. Cause as you say, basically that's what it was. They're going through the card and they were like, well, this show is going to blow chunks. So let's give him a great match, right?
Yeah, and Razor had been doing nothing really at that point, and Sid was really Shawn Michaels' number one foe at that point. Yeah, it is very, very, very good.
Yeah, it is good, and I remember this was the first SummerSlam I ever saw, believe it or not.
Right.
It sucked, but, you know, I will say this, that match did save the show for me.
It did.
And all this time thinking, you guys mentioned it like twice about how this show sucked on paper or whatever, and they added it.
Yeah.
That's 1995 for you right there. Again, yeah. it really fits its time.
One match is good or
like,
so usually.
Yeah, and it's like the fact that somebody had to look at the card and say it sucked to add this is insane.
Yeah, I mean, like the problem too was that Vince was getting they're starting to get very overwhelmed because there was turning into nuclear proliferation with pay-per-views being added every month, right?
Right.
Yeah. They were doing all the in-your-house shows now in 1995, and like people were getting very burned out, I think. On the creative end of things. I think that was part of the problem that they were encountering was they had to keep up with WCW and they didn't want to. Vince would have stayed at, you know, 4 to 6 pay-per-views a year forever if he could have, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I think he would have too. It's just that WCW raised the bar there and, right. you know, basically said your move. As we move on to 1996, which was from Cleveland, this was in Pittsburgh, by the way, 95. 1996 had a main event of world champion now, Shawn Michaels, defending against Vader, who had been a feared guy in Japan and WCW. He came into the WWF in January of 96, made his presence known at the Royal Rumble, beat up Gorilla Monsoon the night after, which was a no-no at the time. You know, one had done that.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a big deal.
That was a big
deal.
That
really put him over in my eyes as a heel.
Yep. He beat up Yokozuna, and they had to take him away on a forklift. That's another highlight of Vader's 1996 run. But by August, he found himself in a world title match. And Scott, I wanted to ask you, is there any truth, or is this maybe just an old rumor, that Vader was supposed to go over here and Shawn vetoed it, or is that just some gobbledygook, so to speak?
Not quite. It's close. Nope. Vader was always supposed to not win.
Okay.
Originally, it was not supposed to be Shawn Michaels winning the match in the end either here. It was basically going to just be like a disqualification or some other schmozzy non-finish at the end of it. And then that was going to lead to Survivor Series where Vader would win the title.
Okay.
You know, because then you had It's Time in December, right? Which makes no sense for anything other than Vader coming in as world champion.
Correct.
Well, it was time.
It was time. It's time. That's right. So, but yeah, like Vader was not actually supposed to win the match, but he was also not supposed to lose the match either.
Okay.
Shawn basically, and as noted, Shawn basically threw a fit during the middle of the match on the blown spot, and that was kind of a legendary thing too, where he had a tantrum mid-match, and had some personality conflicts with Vader, and just before the match went in, he basically went to Vince and said, "We're dropping this whole Vader storyline. I don't care what's been advertised. I'm not losing the title to him." And
wow,
they had to kind of redo the whole thing. Yeah, you got to feel kind of bad for Vader.
He got
a real tough break. Yeah, running into the Shawn Michaels thing, which is weird because you'd think Vader would have been the guy that Vince would have favored over somebody like Shawn Michaels, right? Like, you know, but it was a different time then.
True.
It's really a shame because I like Shawn Michaels and I like Vader.
Yeah.
And I don't remember this match being anything of note.
It was okay.
Yeah.
Like, right? I mean,
it was a good match, but it was.
Yeah. I mean, it was okay. It was just, it's like.
Forgettable.
Right. It's just like, looking back. If you saw, like you see now, you know, fans who may have not been around during this time, and they might see Shawn Michaels versus Vader on paper,
they would think, oh,
this is going to be great. And,
you
know,
it's
just a shame that, you know, like you said, all this backstage politics and that it just kind of ended up being whatever.
Yeah.
Yep. Sure. I mean, it was good, but Shawn just didn't want to play ball.
Shawn Michaels never, right?
Yeah, I know. Shocking.
You know, I wanted to further dispel the King of the Ring, Austin 316 myth here, you know, because the WWE narrative seems to be that this King of the Ring promo happened, right?
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, Austin was this big breakout star. No, in fact, he is on the pre-show here.
Yep.
Defeating Yokozuna in about a minute when Yoko broke the rope or something. So it,
I remember that. Though.
I guess I don't have a real question here. I guess I just wanted to point out, maybe either of you tell me if I'm wrong. Austin's push, so to speak, really didn't start, unless I'm wrong, until maybe a month or two later with the Bret Hart feud, right? Like he's on the pre-show here.
Yeah, no, Bret had to push hard to get Austin any kind of push. Like that was pretty much all Bret who, because otherwise Vince didn't see it with Austin, really, is what it amounted to.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how do you miss that? But I mean, I guess Bischoff did too. So I mean,
good point.
Yeah, but he had already given the promo at this point.
Yeah, that's but the promo thing. Is a promo,
yeah,
you know?
However, I do remember the feeling after that, because I saw that pay-per-view live. I there was something with this guy. It's not like he should be in a pre-show.
You're a fan, though. I mean, yeah. Vince didn't see it.
Yeah, but I mean...
Yeah, online, though, people were going crazy for him. Like, as soon as the Austin 316 happened, like the internet was just, boom, 100%
yeah.
pro-Austin, right, the whole way.
Right.
So there was something there. It's just it took a while to follow into the mainstream, essentially.
Right, exactly, because he's here fighting fucking Yokozuna.
Yeah, just like Roman Reigns, you know. So we're all just waiting now for the mainstream to catch up with
yeah,
the internet buzz on.
That's
the
big dog, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to bring up about 96 before we hop ahead to 97, and that would be the Boiler Room Brawl, an extension, an arm, if you will, of the Undertaker-Mankind feud that was going on. This was probably the first in the WWF's more cinematic backstage fights that they would go on to have later on in 98 and 1999. It was, I think, pre-taped. Quinn, do you have any thoughts on the Boiler Room Brawl?
I think it absolutely set Mankind where he needed to be.
Like okay.
This, as a fan watching this, the fact that he beat The Undertaker was a big deal to me.
Yeah, Bearer turned on The Undertaker and Mankind
yeah.
won. Yep.
Yes, and it established like Mankind isn't a weirdo on Superstars anymore that beats up jobbers. Like,
okay.
This to me was his coming out party. I don't know what everybody else thought of it in that sense, but that's for me, this is when I took notice of Mankind.
Okay. Scott, what do you think of this whole thing?
Yeah, no, it was a really good match. It was in fact pre-taped. Well, the first half it was. I mean, obviously when they got the arena and then it was live.
Right.
Otherwise they'd be dealing in weird hologram stuff that wouldn't be around yet.
Not yet.
It was really good. Mankind nearly killed himself.
Off the ladder,
yep. That's the famous thing in Nick Reed wrote in his book mm-hmm. where he landed in the wrong place and was nearly paralyzed. So, you know, another day at the office for Mick Foley, basically. it was a highlight of what I thought was pretty much a kind of lackluster mid-level SummerSlam that I don't really remember much about
yeah.
other than Jerry Lawler, Jake Roberts nonsense.
Oh, yeah, that crap. That was bad.
Yep.
Let's move ahead to 97 now. New Jersey is the site. Once again, finally, wrestling had come back. Televised wrestling had come back to New Jersey, as evidenced by our governor at the time, Christy Todd Whitman,
yes.
and Gorilla Monsoon, I think, of The Undertaker, and they gave her a belt, and they're like, wrestling's back. Let's kill the taxes or something.
In a really awkward thing that they actually showed on television. And weirder for us, I think, because
yeah.
we were actually New Jerseyans
yes.
and we knew who the governor was.
Right.
Like, just a strange thing. But this pay-per-view. Joe, this is like SummerSlam coming back.
This is like, yeah, you know, in a way it is SummerSlam coming back. It's got some feel good moments to it. For a face fan or someone that's maybe, you know, an American at the time, let's say, it's not a feel good moment because in the main event, Bret Hart wins his fifth, as he
yeah,
very much rubbed
five.
In everyone's
yeah.
face when he won, fifth world title from the champion at the time, The Undertaker, because of Shawn Michaels as the ref there, and he hit him with a chair by accident, blah, blah, blah. I thought it was a great way for Bret to go over. I thought it was great for the Bret-Shawn feud. I thought it was great the way it kicked off the Undertaker-Shawn feud, you
yep.
know, which led to DX.
Right.
Scott, your overall thoughts on that Bret Hart-Undertaker match and the ensuing angle?
Well, I mean, like, this was obviously a banner time to be a fan of the Hart Foundation
yeah.
in Canada, so everything was kind of leading up to there. I felt like Jim Cornette's fingerprints were a little too much all over the show, though, as far as the booking goes with, you know, British Bulldog has to eat a can of dog food if he loses or
that.
And,
yeah.
You know, like,
there is some weird
yeah,
stipulations.
Owen Hart has to kiss Steve Austin has to kiss Owen Hart's ass if he loses and all that kind of, like, that's all very much Jim Cornette's Southern booking philosophy.
Yeah, I think even more so the Brian Pillman having to wear a dress.
Brian Pillman wearing a dress.
That's really Southern.
Yeah, that shit belongs in Smoky Mountain or something like that. What are we doing here, Cornette? Thinks he's so good. But yeah, you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, Scott, the dog food match there. What were they doing with Ken Shamrock at this point? That seems to me like a waste of him and his talent and the way to market him.
Yeah, I know. It was a strange, strange thing. Like famously, Eric Bischoff has said that he created Goldberg soon after as a way to show the WWF exactly how they should have been using Ken Shamrock all along. Right. So, I mean,
yeah, score one for Bischoff in that category.
Score one for Bischoff. Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, Shamrock went from coming in with a pretty legit angle to him, you know, like he was a shoot fighter. He beat up Vader, and I guess he actually hurt him too in real life, but he beat up Vader, right? And he was doing like submission moves and stuff. And now he's fighting a match with the British Bulldog where if he loses, he has to eat dog food.
I mean, it's weird. What are you going to say?
Jim Cornette was a genius, obviously, though, Quinn.
I mean, the one thing I do notice, because I've been watching some of the Raws building up to this,
right?
A lot of what all these stipulations, the logical sense of it was that the Hart Foundation was kind of shooting their mouths off a lot. I recall in the Raws saying,
yes,
you know, Brett, I'm not going to wrestle in America. And then after that, it like triggered everyone doing a stipulation.
You know, another one that might be forgotten is actually that Jim Neidhart said that if any of the Hart Foundation members lost, he would shave his goatee.
Yes.
But he disappeared. He disappeared after this.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then he reappeared later and the whole thing was forgotten. So I think that was a little bit of a cop out there. Obviously, you know, some other things that happened at SummerSlam that I just want to gloss over real quick. Owen Hart, you know, and Steve Austin, we all know what happened there with the neck injury.
Yeah.
Sad, because it couldn't have happened, you know, to the worst guy in terms of like the wrong timing.
Right.
With Austin, and by a nicer, well-meaning guy.
Yeah.
Than Owen Hart.
That being said, Steve Austin was living on borrowed time.
One way or another.
The doctors had already told him he had the neck of a 90-year-old man.
Before this?
Before that even, yeah. So, I mean, people assign a lot of the blame to Owen Hart and that, but I mean, at some point or another, he was going to take a bad bump and it was going to be all over, right? So, I mean, like, it wasn't great of Owen Hart to do the path for that way.
Just
sit down like that. But I mean, like, at the same time, though, I mean, like, Austin had, it was kind of like Tyson Kidd, right? Like, he was, he only had so many punches left on the bump card, as they say.
Right, I got you.
You know, as silly as that whole thing came off with him pinning Owen, it still was kind of a feel-good thing in a weird way.
Austin won the IC title finally.
Yeah, I don't know. They did what they could.
They did what they could. It was doomed, though.
They did. That would never, ever happen today, of course. I mean, as soon as that happened, the match would be stopped, and that would be down, and they'd be like, fans, the performance is over. And
right, exactly. This is not part of tonight's entertainment.
Yeah.
This is not part of tonight's entertainment. Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, you know, I mean, God, like, it's like the guts on Steve Austin to, like, can you imagine? Yeah. He basically has paralysis, and he still manages to get behind Owen and pin him and then walk out to the
kind
of his own power. God, this guy is crazy tough. No wonder he became such a superstar.
You're absolutely right. As we hop ahead to 98, this is now back at Madison Square Garden where it all began.
Right.
10 years later, and we are on the highway to hell, Quinn.
Oh,
as we mentioned Monday, great theme song.
Oh,
they were using
fantastic
licensed music, right? And
yeah,
great main event. I thought it is the Undertaker challenging Stone Cold Steve Austin for the world title. We talked about this Monday, Quinn. Great match. Scott, since Quinn and I already talked about it in our previous show, what do you think of that whole match there?
Well, I mean, obviously it was a little bit weird because Steve Austin knocked himself loopy early in the match, and it ended up essentially being Undertaker working the whole match like himself,
it's
just like
true.
Bret Hart did, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So this SummerSlam was actually did more buys than a lot of WrestleManias did, which is kind of astonishing how hot wrestling was in the Attitude Era. I mean, it did 700,000 buys, which is WrestleMania numbers. Cause it's like, hey, how about that? You take a hot wrestling star who's world champion, put him up against another big star and promote the hell out of it, and people will buy the show. How about that, huh?
Yeah. But, what a concept.
What a concept. Yeah. No, I mean, I thought it was a good match. I think Austin's really hardened himself even today now. He does these podcast interviews where he basically talks about how disappointed he was ended up being in the match because, you know, he got hurt early and didn't really know what was going on for the rest of it. But I think it's a fantastic card up and down, I think.
I think so, too.
It's one of my favorite SummerSlams. It's, you know, feel-good moments.
I would say this is the closest thing akin to the old-style SummerSlams.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
this is the Attitude Era's version of like a SummerSlam 91.
Absolutely,
like,
is.
It just feels like, let's feature all the cool stuff we're doing in this super fun card. And it's no wonder it did the buys you said it did, Scott.
Austin fighting The Undertaker. You had The Rock fighting Triple H for the Intercontinental title in a ladder match. You had the Outlaws teaming up against Mankind. It was supposed to be Kane and Mankind. Let's go to 99 now. We go to Minneapolis. And one of the things that happened here was a triple threat match. It was the main event for the world title. It was the champion Steve Austin versus Triple H versus Mick Foley. Scott, I want to ask you, because you'll know better than either of us will. You'll remember more and you probably have more insight. Why wasn't this just Austin and Triple H one-on-one for the world title if they were going to give the world title to Triple H anyway?
Yeah, so they wanted to. There was a couple of different factors involved in it, but the long and the short of it is that Steve Austin didn't really want to lose the world title to Triple H, and Jesse Ventura didn't really want to be involved with holding up the hand of the heel in Minneapolis at the end of the show. And there was a couple of other factors as well, but that's kind of the main ones. And so they were just like, okay, well, we'll stick Mick Foley in there because Steve Austin had no problem putting over Mick Foley. So Foley could lose in the 24 hours after that. He could then lose the title to Triple H because at that point, Steve Austin wouldn't give a shit. So
right. Yes.
You know, that's kind of what worked out best for everybody to do there.
That's kind of what I figured. It just, when I saw that one live, believe it or not, I was ready for Austin to not be champion anymore. I was okay with it.
Yeah.
I really thought Triple H was winning. And when Foley hit that double arm DDT on Austin and pinned him clean, I think even the crowd was kind of like, what?
Yeah, everybody thought Triple H was winning that match. And I mean, Triple H thought he was winning that match too up until a couple months before the match, right? So,
yeah.
But then there was the whole weird buildup with it too beforehand, where like China was involved in the match.
Yeah.
For a while, but, you know, just all kinds of crazy Russo nonsense.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And exactly. And the governor's telling them what to do and changing the booking too. And what the hell's going on?
I mean, and Jesse Ventura was involved with the match out of spite against WCW more than anything too, which was really funny because he had the longstanding feud with Vince McMahon. But I guess he hated WCW even more for the way that, you know, that their relationship ended. So he wanted to put the screws to Eric Bischoff specifically. So it just goes to show the power of hatred.
Yeah. There you go. Quinn, what do you think of that main event?
I mean, it's funny. The most I remember of this is just Jesse raising hands at the end.
And he has the long sleeve ref shirt too, which
is weird. Yeah. I mean, this SummerSlam, right?
Not good.
We went from like, you know, oh, it's feel good SummerSlam again, right? To just another, like, this could have just been an In Your House.
This could have been
something.
An In Your House, yeah.
Like,
could have been fully loaded.
You know, you look at this card. I do remember the Greenwich Street fight.
That's good.
Yeah.
Test Shane is good.
And I also remember slightly the whole Ken Shamrock versus Steve Blackman in a Lion's Den.
Another Lion's Den, huh?
Yeah. The next year.
I didn't remember that, actually. Yeah. I knew they fought, but, you know, can we talk about real quick and then we'll hop over to 2000? Why did they want to push Billy Gunn so hard, Scott?
Because he's tall and muscular and had a full head of hair. Those are the three qualities you need to be a top level WWF star.
I guess that's true.
They'd been trying for 3 years. Like,
you're right. Really didn't work, huh?
Really did not work. No, I mean, I was just, not only he got a bad match out of The Rock, but then he got a bad match out of Chris as well a year later, right? It's like, well, how do you do that?
Yeah, maybe it's him. Maybe we start to connect the dots. Maybe it's Billy Gunn.
It took long enough, didn't it? But then again, he's coming off the heels of the one of the best tag teams of the 90s, as I said.
Yeah, one of the most popular tag teams anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, to some people, they would be the best tag team because they were so popular, you know?
I feel like, though, in the feud with The Rock, at the point when The Rock did the famous promo where God himself is mocking Billy Gunn as a top draw.
Yes.
Maybe it's not going to work out so well for you. I don't know.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that Billy Gunn made it all the way up to the match before the main event of a pay-per-view.
All I'm saying is that, you know, at least they tried with Billy Gunn, you know, like they had reason. Yes. They had reason to, let's put it that way.
Yeah, but they tried again the following year. That's the bigger problem.
That's the bigger problem. But at this point, I can see it.
Okay, you know, fair enough.
That's all. I'm just pointing it out in the time frame, the context. You know?
All right, well, let's head down south to Raleigh, North Carolina, as we go to SummerSlam 2000, one that I saw. This is during a year, folks, where almost every pay-per-view was good. In 2000, almost. Maybe 8 out of 12, 9 out of 12. A lot of them were really good. And SummerSlam was a good one. And there's a few highlights I want to just bring up real quick. One of them is we had a very interesting and pretty damn good hardcore match between Steve Blackman and Shane McMahon. Remember that one, Scott?
I remember Shane McMahon nearly dying, but I don't really remember the match itself, to be honest.
Not bad, honestly. I mean, not an all-time classic by any means.
I mean, really, overall for the show, I only remember two matches, and everything else is just a total blur. But I mean, like...
What else do you got from there?
I mean, you know, the Triple Threat main event, obviously, and then the first ever TLC match.
First ever TLC.
Great match.
That set a template, you know, that set a template that they still try to attain today, even in their toned down, you know, way. They still try to find things like that.
And not only that, there was a weird bit of weirdness with the build up, right? Because... Yeah, the Dudley boys who are the, you know, masters of the tables, and you had, you know, the Hardy boys who are the masters of the ladders.
Right.
So in order to get to it, then they wanted a TLC match. So then they had to go backwards and start doing all the stuff where Edge and Christian were using chairs all the time. Right. And
right.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of retcon it.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, they retcon it. Right. So that way then Edge and Christian, they had this strange thing where it's like, oh, my God, they have chairs. They're, you know. These dangerous chair swinging lunatics, right?
They're chairmen now.
Yeah,
they're chairmen. Yeah, yeah,
they're La Parka.
Yeah,
yeah. So it was an interesting way to, and you know, obviously that stuck with them, you know, for years afterwards too, right?
Right.
So that was, I thought that was an interesting little way to book the match backwards.
Yeah,
it was, and it worked. I mean, hey, it was very well remembered.
It was very successful.
Very successful.
Very successful. Although I'm frankly surprised they were in Raleigh, North Carolina. Like, why didn't the Hardy Boys win the match? Right? Like, you'd think that would.
Because the hometown heroes always win.
Yeah, heroes always win. Yeah, I know. Well, okay, and they won the next month anyway. So, like,
yeah, you're right.
Looking at this card real quick, The Undertaker versus Kane
that
is sucked. On this card.
That was dumb.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
That was supposed to be Undertaker against Big Show, but Big Show was having his problems. So,
oh, that's right. He was gone for a while, right?
Yeah, he got written out of the show because Jim Ross was mad at him for not losing enough weight or. You know, whatever the deal was exactly. So that was his punishment, is that he was taken off the card and replaced with Kane.
You gotta lose more weight, our Big Show. You gotta.
That's something coming from JR.
You don't look cool. You don't look cool. You gotta take some laps in the swimming pool. And then one other thing I wanted to bring up: the main event was pretty damn good in the height of the Chris Kresge love triangle that everyone seems to love, and including myself. But
yeah.
Got to ask you this one, Scott. Now, Quinn, I actually, you know, I'm going to start with you, Quinn, because this is a stupid match that happened there and it was a stupid feud. Taz, Jerry Lawler, what the hell was going on there, Quinn?
I don't know. Like,
Why did they do that?
Okay, you want to know how I remember Taz in the WWE
in general? Yeah.
He comes in with the, like, jumpsuit and he immediately sucks. Like, Like, I honestly forgot this existed.
Right, exactly.
Like, no joke. Like,
it's such a waste of them. They had him feud with an announcer. Scott, why?
I don't know. Even more important, like, then why did they hire Raven? It's like, you know,
yeah.
Like, who the fuck hired Raven, right? Like,
yeah. Who the fuck hired Raven?
It was such a weird thing. And, like, I don't know what they're doing with Taz, honestly, at that point.
And, like, the weirder part of this whole thing is the feud started because Taz was picking on JR and King, who was a heel, punched Taz because King always punches people, whether it's Santino,
it's
you know. Yeah, he just punches people. And then he's like, Lola, you... Oh, and then...
Hey, Lola, you better sit your ass down before you get choked out. This is between him and me. Sit down. Shut up.
And then JR hit him with a candy dish. Because again, the candy dish.
Oh, he's with the candy dish in 2000.
Oh, you son of a bitch. I'm going to hit you, you son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And then the next month, I think it was, Raven came out of nowhere and killed the King with Taz, and everyone was happy. Because enough of this.
Oh, there you go. And that's all you need to know about Taz in the WWE.
Ugh. And folks, we'll do one more pay-per-view here. We always consider, you know, our retro period to go up to around, you know, the early 2000s. And I figured it was only fitting that we cap it off with kind of the end of the Attitude Era here, which was, most people agree, was 2001. SummerSlam 2001 from San Jose, California. Couple of good highlights here. One of which was Rob Van Dam versus Jeff Hardy.
Oh, yeah.
RVD won the hardcore title.
I remember that. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, and you got to remember, ECW had only closed, you know, earlier in the year. Pretty big deal to see Rob Van Dam winning, you know, a hardcore title, but a title on WWF television from Jeff Hardy.
Now, you have to remember, we're in the midst of the Invasion feud.
Yes, we are. It's still going on.
People have representation here.
Absolutely.
So that's probably why RVD was being pushed.
And
that
he should have been. I mean, he still had gas in the tank. Scott, any recollections of that?
Yeah, I mean, RVD should have been a much bigger star based off that whole thing. Like,
yeah,
they completely dropped the ball with that one. Like, they he could have come in and won the world title like pretty much right away, I think.
Right.
No, definitely.
He could have, and people would have bought it.
And he was still remembered from that whole time that ECW was on WWF.
From 97,
and he was Mr. Monday Night.
Yep.
People knew who he was.
And especially with ECW on TNN in 99 and 2000, his series with Jerry Lynn, for what it's worth, I mean, it's a little overrated in terms of the quality of the wrestling.
It's okay.
But it did actually attract a lot of attention amongst wrestling fans at the time.
Right.
And he was accessible on national television.
Right.
Or Nashville television, maybe. but also at this pay-per-view, something that was really horrible was Kane and The Undertaker beating the crap out of DDP and Canyon.
Ugh.
And Scott, I wanted to talk to you about that because Quinn and I, we know DDP was old by this point. He was 45. But don't you think they really blew it with DDP and the WWF?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That whole thing was just ridiculous spite against WCW and all kinds of nonsense.
Right.
Like that. It was the fact that, you know, Undertaker just completely squashed him basically single-handedly.
Right.
That match was ludicrous, and then led to Chronic coming in, and they looked like complete goofs as well.
Chronic.
It's so ridiculous. They had a bona fide star, and even if, like you said, the 45 thing, I think we discussed this before, even if they could get like a year out of him, it would have been worth it.
Right, as a top-level guy, or near the top, maybe.
Yeah.
That's what never made sense. It's like he was the stalker, right?
Right.
And he takes off the mask. He gets a huge pop. I remember that.
DDP is the stalker.
Everyone's like, holy shit, it's
awesome.
DDP, right?
Yeah.
Undertaker literally just beats him up until DDP leaves or something.
Yep.
I don't know.
That's pretty much what it was, yeah.
Well, Joe, he had to get revenge for Sarah.
Sarah Taker.
Yeah, Sarah Taker.
Everybody loves Sarah Taker, yeah.
Yeah.
That is, did people actually call her that back on your old website, Scott?
Yeah, I feel they used like to call her Sarah Undertaker, yeah.
Sarah Undertaker. And finally, we'll talk about real quick what I thought should have been a bigger deal in hindsight. Maybe it was, and maybe I don't remember it as such, but that would be The Rock versus Booker T for the WCW title. Very weird to see that title defended,
in a
main event of a WWE event, but also a meeting of two pretty big stars. I mean, pretty big, probably understated for The Rock, but Booker T, when he still had a lot of life left in him.
So over at this point.
That was a big marquee match, I thought.
Yeah.
Do you have memories of that one at all, Scott?
It was a very forgettable match. I mean, there was a bunch of...
Yeah,
I mean, I remember there was a bunch of bullshit with Shane McMahon and that, but I mean, I remember more about both Steve Austin Kurt Angle match than than the Rock Booker T match.
Right.
That was at that point, I was kind of in with a bunch of the writers in WWE, so I mean, like, they were all championing the Kurt Angle stuff, so that's kind of the stuff I heard about when I was chatting with them. So like, I didn't really hear much about the Booker T match, and it was a very forgettable match as well.
It was forgettable, right? And I always feel like it should have been bigger, but you're right. I mean, Angle really came into his own during the Invasion angle. I mean, no pun intended, but like, he really became a breakout star of that whole thing.
Yeah, which can make more of the shame that they screwed everything up so badly the way they did.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I mean, this at this SummerSlam, this should have been the real, like, you know, the Invasion angle should have taken off at this point.
Yeah, as a follow up to the month before.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Like, to this day, we could do a whole freaking episode about the failure of that. But I mean, you got so many. The whole pay per view is structured as a, you know, Alliance versus WWF and all this. And
no, it is.
I don't know. It's just they just dropped the ball. As we know with all this.
They did. But more often than not, I feel like a lot of these older SummerSlams, they didn't drop the ball. And that's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
And I think to bring it back around here before we wrap up, the SummerSlam as a pay-per-view, especially in the 90s, you know, maybe the first half of the 90s, really was a feel-good show for the most part, where the faces won. And it was the dead of summer, you know, and it just felt good.
Yeah.
And I've had a good time, I gotta say. It's bringing back a lot of memories, you know. Had a good time reminiscing with you gentlemen.
Well, it was great.
It was great. Folks, if you're watching SummerSlam this Sunday, have fun doing that.
Yeah.
But until then, folks, we will be back on Monday for episode number 45. We want to thank the one and only Scott Keith, the number one Zeus fan, apparently, for being with us. Scott, as always, thank you so much. And a shout out to the Blog of Doom out there.
Yep. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. And of course, you can find me at blogofdoom.com. I'm on Twitter at RSBWFAQ. I'm on Facebook as well, facebook.com/RSBWFAQ. Yeah. Also, wait for Inside Pulse. And you can find me every week on the Sporting News around Wednesday. You can do a list.
There you have it. And he's also obtaining Zeus autographs, you know, on the weekends. So until Monday, folks, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. We will see you on Monday.
See ya.
You know, I think when most people imagine that you got to fight your brother-in-law in the SummerSlam, that it's going to break up a lot of families, and that's exactly what's happening. This whole family of mine is falling apart. People are picking sides. Everybody's involved. Everybody's mad. Everybody's... The tension, you wouldn't believe the tension. But let me tell you something. It took me a long time to climb to the top. I got the title. I got the Intercontinental title, and it took the British Bulldog a long time to climb to the top, and we're both there. And we both got to do what we got to do. And in the SummerSlam, the British Bulldog
is going to win, whether he wants to or not.
By now, Gene Okerlund with Ravishing Rick Rude and Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Gentlemen, as you know, the Ultimate Warrior.
Nice move.